November 6th, 1996, and we're starting the new Masechta.
Masechta Sota.
Sota.
Okay. All right. First of all, simply wanted to say one word that we had a very beautiful siyum, and I appreciate the fact that we're able to be together to celebrate, and we should continue to learn and to enjoy more simchas in the future as well. The Gemara that we're starting tonight, Sota, is of course based upon what we find in the Torah. And that's why I took out a couple of the Herz Chumashim. So we'll take a look for a few moments at the background of this particular Gemara. We find in Parsha Noso, okay, yeah, if we would take a look in our Chumash on page 589, it is part of the fifth chapter of the Sefer Bamidbar, and in it we find that the following. It says that, you know, Hashem spoke to Moshe saying, speak to the children of Israel, say to them, that if a man has, if any man's woman, any man's wife, excuse me, has gone astray, literally. The word soto means actually to turn aside from the path, all right? So if she has strayed from the path, which means that she acted, well, here it says unfaithfully against him, okay? And if somebody, a man, has slept with her, right? And it was hidden from the eyes of the husband, right? And she was defiled secretly, right? V'nistara, it says, v'hinit mo'a. We'll come back to some of these words again in the Gemara. And then it says, v'eid ein bo'a, and there is no witness against her. V'hilay nisposa, nor was she literally caught in the act. Okay? So, then it says, v'yovar lo ruach kina. So, if the spirit of jealousy come upon him, and he jealous of his wife because of the fact that she has been defiled, or possibility that he's jealous of her and he's angry with her, but she has not sinned. So in that case, what happens? So there's a whole ceremony then that's involved. He has to bring his wife to the Kohen, of course, in the base of Mikdash, right, on Mishkan in the Midlus, and there we have finally the act which is taken, that the Kohen has to bring her, you know, before the holy, you know, in the Azor over there, the courtyard of the Beis HaMikdash, and he has to take Loka Hakeim Ayim Kedoshim Mekli Choras. The priest has to take holy water. Notice it's shades of Catholicism, right?
Mm-hmm.
So he has to take holy water, which is in a Kli Choras, in other words, in an earthen vessel. And then he takes from the dust on the ground of the floor of the tabernacle, and he puts it, he adds it to the water, and then the priest has to station her before the Lord, literally, and he has to undo her hair, and he's to losan akapes minchas hazikaron. In other words, she has to bring a meal offering, which he places in her hands, and then he has to make her swear that, you know, and he says that if no man has lain with thee, if you have not gone aside to uncleanness while you are, you know, together with your husband, then be free from this water of bitterness that causes the curse. But if she has actually committed adultery, then in that case the priest shall cause the woman to swear, and the priest says that may God send a curse upon you, so that your thigh falls away, your belly swells, and the water shall go into thy bowels, etc., etc., and so on and so forth. Let's say, Amen, Amen. Then he takes the curses that he has uttered, and he has to write them on a scroll. And then what does he do? He takes the water that he has caused her to drink, but also he takes some of the water, and he blots out the reading in the scroll. Okay? And then afterwards, you know, they take the meal offering, and then it shall come to pass, you know, that if she was really guilty, then the curses that were uttered upon her will be fulfilled. But if she's not guilty, then she will be rewarded by virtue of the fact that, you know, her husband will be reconciled with her and she'll give birth and so on and so forth. It's a mark of reconciliation. Okay. This, in general, is what this particular chapter has to say. And then, when we finish this, immediately after that, there is another chapter, and that is the chapter that deals with a person who takes the vow of being a Nozir. Okay? Take a look, that's chapter 6 in the Chumash, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Takes a vow of being a Nozir. And of course, what does a Nozir have to do? Essentially, he has several commitments, several vows that he has to take.
Mm-hmm.
One is the fact that he has to abstain from eating grapes in any form whatever, whether it's skin, whether it's bits, whether it's in the form of wine, and so on. He's not allowed to do that. He also has to let his hair grow, and he's not allowed to come into contact with the dead. Okay? So, and then afterwards, when the time of the Naziris has passed, then he has to bring a sacrifice to God in order to be absolved from the vow that he has taken. Okay? And there's a whole, you know, the chapter describes exactly what is the procedure for that. Now, it so happens that, therefore, we have two Masechtas. One is Sota, and the other one is
Nozir.
Okay? And each one deals particularly with the particular subject matter that we have. Okay? Yes.
Why would one become a Nozir? A
person would become a Nozir primarily as an act of wanted to feel more holy or something, consecration. And so therefore he took upon himself this. Well, I have to point out to you that the accepted opinion in the Gemara is that nevertheless he has sinned by taking this vow of Naziris, because he has deprived himself of things that the Ribbono Shel Olam said to us are permitted unto us. And he went and he did, you know, he deprived himself of these things. And so therefore he is a sinner in that respect. So
by becoming a Nazir.
Right. So obviously not everybody was very happy about the idea of Naziris. But the basic idea behind it is, you know, that for a period of time he dedicates his life to God by giving up pleasures in life and by refraining from coming in any contact with any kind of tumor at that particular time.
That include women and so forth?
Yes, a woman could also take upon herself.
No, I mean, he has to abstain from...
No. He's allowed to live a normal life, but as I said, contact with the dead would be prohibited.
Like,
and of course, in general, I mean contact with tumen, let's say, touching a carcass, a reptile, you know, these things, you know, that convey tumor, as we find in Sefer Vayikra particularly, okay? So that's what it is. But they did not expect the Nazir to simply give up his life, because the Nazirim could also be married and have children.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, let us continue right now. Gemara starts in with the following Mishnah. Mishnah says, Hamakane Leishta. If a man literally is jealous of his wife, but as we'll see, really this is a technical term over here, because the way they interpret Mekane is in the sense that, you know, he is suspicious that his wife has been engaged in misconduct. Okay, what kind of misconduct, we'll see in a second. Alright, so if a man now feels that you know, his wife has and not behave the way she's supposed to behave, then Rabbi Eliezer Omer, Rabbi Eliezer says, Mekane lo al pishnayim. He says that he cannot initiate anything unless there are two witnesses, you know, to the fact that she...
been unfaithful.
She, well, not necessarily unfaithful, but she is guilty of some action of misconduct against him. Doesn't mean necessarily that she has to be unfaithful.
Mm-hmm.
it could be, you know, let's say, as we'll see in a moment, that what actually has transpired at this point in time is that he noticed that she's too friendly with a certain man. Okay? So he gives her warning that she's been seen by witnesses together with this man, and it's a compromising situation, and that therefore she should not have anything more to deal with him. This is the first stage. This is first Bekani. Okay? All right. Umashke al pi eid echad, o al pi atzman. According to Rabbi Eliezer, as far as going to the next step, where he causes her to drink this water, this mayim hamaorim, literally the waters of curse that we spoke about when we went over the chapter in the Torah, right? So for that, one witness is sufficient. What do I mean, one witness? One witness, the fact that she has definitely committed misconduct. Okay? So that would be enough. Or al pi atzmo, he himself could be so suspicious of her that he says that, you know, he wants that, he's seen something that's not right over there, and he wants her to be tested. Okay? Rabbi Yehoshua Omer, Rabbi Yehoshua disagrees with Rabbi Eliezer. He says, Mekani lo al pi shnayim, he agrees with Rabbi Eliezer that when it comes, you know, to initiate the procedure, that they need two witnesses to first testify to that fact, because otherwise there are no grounds for it, right? But umashkal pishnaim, he says that we need actually two witnesses before the husband can bring her, you know, to the kohen and insist, you know, that she drink the mayim hamaorim. Okay? So the Mishnah now explains what they mean by mekani. It says, Ketsa mekani lo. How? What is the procedure of this mekani? He says, Umilo, he says to her, Bifnei Shnaim, in the presence of two witnesses, he says to her, Al tadabri imish pleni. Do not talk with so-and-so, okay, with this and this man. In other words, I don't want you to have anything further to do with this person. Then what happens? With Dibroimo, nevertheless, she continued to talk to this person. So at Orion, so at any rate, at this particular point, the Mishnah says, Adayin hi muteres leveso, muteres lecho betruma. She, at this point, is still permitted to live together with her husband, and of course it means also to have marital relations with him, right? Umuteres, and she's also permitted lecho betruma. If the husband were a Kohen, so, you know, according to the law of the Torah, truma can be eaten by the Kohen, by his family, his immediate family, and also even by his servants and so on and so forth. Okay? So, in this particular case, if he were a Kohen, she still would be permitted to eat truma over there because of the fact that all that she's done is to simply receive a warning. Don't talk with this person anymore. Don't have anything more to do with him. Now, nichnaso imo leveis hasefer. Slight slip of the trunk. What happens if she entered together with him into a secret rendezvous? And she stayed long enough with him so that an act of what shall we say, defilement, right, could have taken place. Obviously it means, you know, that it was possible to have relations. So in that particular case, then she is atzura leveso. She is prohibited to her husband from this particular point on. Atzura lechol betruma, and she is prohibited from eating truma if he were a kohen. And then the Mishnah concludes by saying, v'im meis. And what would happen if the husband died, and of course he died before the, you know, he had an opportunity to schlep her to the Beis HaMikdash, you know, for the you know, to have her go through this ordeal, right? Then in that case, choletzes v'lo misyabetz. In that particular case, if he has a brother, of course we're talking about the fact, you know, that she had no children. Mm. Okay, so if she had no children and he has a brother, then the rule is that the brother has to give her chalitza. The brother cannot marry her. Okay? Cannot be miyabe. Remember that miyabe means that he marries her. Actually, she becomes his wife, and then according to the law of the Torah, the first child that is born will be named after the dead husband, and presumably he'll also inherit, you know, what belonged to the dead husband. This is yibum. But if she doesn't like him, or if he doesn't like her, or there are grounds where yibum is considered a wrong thing, then in that particular case we have chalitza, the ceremony whereby, you know, the two of them come before the Beis Din, and then she has to remove his shoe, and she has to say, you know, this shall be done to the person, you know, who refuses to raise up his brother's house in Israel, and so on and so forth. Okay, so of course the day, in any rate, I mean, if we would have a situation like this, we don't have yibum, we have only chalitza. But there, as we say, we see that you know, where it was more common to have the ceremony either of yibum or chalitza, so in this particular case yibum is out of the question. Only chalitza can be observed in this particular case. Alright, so now let's take a look at the Rashi and see what he has to say over here. Alright, the Mishnah starts then, as we saw, Hamakani Liishno. So Rashi says Lishton the Kronokat. In other words, why do they use the term Mekane? After all, normal meaning of the word Mekane would be to be jealous.
Jealous.
And yet here it isn't so much a question of jealousy as it is a fact, you know, that he's disturbed by her conduct, and he warns her that he doesn't want her to engage in further communication, you know, with a person of whom he's very suspicious that they're too friendly. So therefore Rashi explains that the word Hamakane is because Lishna de Kronokat, he took the language that the Torah itself uses. Torah says Vikine Yesishta. Okay, well, a common big Gemara, and further on in the Gemara, Meforish is going to explain my Loshin Kinui, what is the meaning of this language Kinui. V'mas Nisan, and in the Mishnah, Meforish, he explains Ketzad Mekane Lo, how does he proceed with this process? Okay, Omer Lo, he says to her first, Al Tisosri Emish Ploni, right? Do not have any secret meetings with so and so. Okay. Yeah. Mekane Lo Al Pishnayim, so he needs two witnesses, right? In Bola Hashkoisan, if he's going to go through with the ordeal of having her drink the Mayim HaMa'orim, then in that particular case, Sorech Lahovishnei Edim, he has to bring two witnesses, She'omar Lo Bifneihem, that he said to her in their presence, Al Tisosri Imo, do not have any secret relations with him. V'yim Lo Kinei Lo Bifnei Shnayim, but what if it happened that he did not give her this warning in the presence of two witnesses, then in that case, Eino Ne'aseres Alav Mistirasa V'yeinu Mashken, and in that particular case, she would not be prohibited to him, even if she subsequently had a private meeting with the other man, and he's not allowed, you know, to have her go through the ordeal of drinking the Mayim HaMa'orim. Alright, so as we see, both Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yeshua are in agreement that as far as the initial procedure, it has to warn her in the presence of two witnesses. It has to be two witnesses. But they are in disagreement as to, and then if something else happens further, and he wants to take her to the Beis HaMikdash, you know, for the ordeal, then how many witnesses would be required to testify of the fact that they saw her doing something that was definitely not right after she had already been warned? So, according to Rabbi Eliezer, it's only one, right? Mashke al pi ed echad, or al pi atzmo, or he says even he himself could be the only witness, you know, that he wants to hear it. Afilo ein edim shenistara, even if there are no witnesses, you know, that she was hidden, that she was in a secret rendezvous with the man. Elo eid echad, except for one witness, right? Oh, hu atzmo omer, or he himself says, re'isiha shenistera. I saw her, and I saw that she was at a secret rendezvous. Acha shekinesila, after I have already warned her, you know, not to. So in that case, what happens? Ne'aseres bistira, she becomes prohibited by virtue of the fact that she had the secret rendezvous, right? Ad shetishta, until she drinks the maimor. In other words, it means that she cannot have marital relations with him, as we saw, nor if he were Kohen, as the Mishnah says a little further on, right? Would she be permitted to eat truma, right? Well, the kavon yafin and mikroi, and later on we're going to learn from Sukkim in the Torah, she stirasa usato alav misafek, that the very fact, you know, that she had a secret rendezvous will automatically make her prohibited unto him because of the doubt as to, you know, whether she did do something or she didn't do anything. But at any rate, because her actions were suspicious enough, so that therefore she could not live with him. Now that's according to Rabbi Eliezer, that one witness would be enough for that purpose, or even if there were no witnesses, but the husband himself says, I saw her. Okay. Rabbi Yehoshua disagrees with Rabbi Yezmi and says, Sorech Beish Edim after Stirasa, that she requires two witnesses even concerning the fact that, you know, they saw her in a secret rendezvous. If there were only one witness according to him, it would not be sufficient to do what? The answer is to make her prohibited and to have her go through the ordeal of bitter waters. Okay. And then, of course, if you remember, the Mishnah says that if he warns her, right, in the presence of two witnesses, and he says, don't talk with the son, and then it says, v'dibra imo, and she spoke with him, shelo b'mekom seser, in a place which is open to public view. In other words, the people see simply that she's talking to a guy in the street or in the store or something like that, but not in a secret rendezvous. Then in that case, we said that adayim uteres l'veisot, she is still permitted to her husband, l'veisot literally to her house, but it's understood, I mean, it means to her husband, as he says, l'shamishim ba'alot, to have intercourse, to have marital relations with her husband. Umuteres v'truma, and she's also permitted to eat truma, and meshes koinhi, she's the wife of a kohen. But what happens, says the Mishnah, if Nichnisa Imona Beis HaSefer, Beis HaSefer, again, my tongue veyes me, I'm telling you. There must be a psashed working on my tongue tonight. Okay. But what happens if she remained long enough with this person, Kedei Tumor, which Rashi tells us means Kedei Ha'arah? Now, that I have to explain. We had that once in one of the Gemaras that we learned, probably in Kedushin. Question is, at what point can we consider sexual intercourse to have taken place? Okay? So, if they were just fooling around, that's not yet sexual intercourse in order to prohibit, you know, everything else. But if actually he began, you know, the process of, you know, inserting his penis into her vagina, then that's harah. That's already sexual intercourse, even if it doesn't go all the way in and it doesn't stay long or whatever it may be. Okay? So that's one interpretation of what harah is. However, there is another interpretation of harah which says that it doesn't require that. It doesn't require the actual intromission. Mm-hmm. That's enough if, you know, they play around with each other and they stimulate each other, you know. Sexually aroused. That's harah too. So at any rate, whether you accept one interpretation or whether you accept the other interpretation, but it's not going to make any difference in this case. If she's there long enough so that the impression will begin, you know, people saw that she went into a secret hiding place with him, she stayed for a certain amount of period, and presumably during that time it was sufficient for a sexual act to take place, then in that case, what happens? Then, of course, we say that she's asura lebeisa, right? She's prohibited to her husband, asura lechol betruma, right? She cannot eat truma anymore, right? And then, what's the rest? Yes, let me see, the rest of the Rashi over here? Yeah. Okay, so asura lebeisa, he says, misopik. He says, she is still prohibited to her husband because of the doubt, the fact, you know, that maybe this kind of conduct took place between her and the man whom she was warned not to, or maybe not. Can you outfit in the comments? We'll learn afterwards. Shlosha benit me'or amurim beparshan. Says in the Torah itself, you know, the one that we looked at, the word benit me'or occurs actually three times. The kine is ishto, right? If he literally was jealous of his wife, but as we've already interpreted, you know, he gave a warning, right? And she has become defiled. Then the next one says, "Venistera v'hinitma." She was hidden. In other words, she was concealed, right, with the, you know, with the man who she was not supposed to have anything to do with, and she became defiled. And then it says, "Tachas isha." In place of her husband, in other words, intercourse has taken place and she has become defiled. So, why three times does the word benit ma'or occur in the parsha over there? So it says, Echod shasur lebal. One of them is to tell us that she is prohibited to her husband. Alright? The Echod shasur leboel. And one is the fact that she's not only prohibited to have anything, you know, any more relations with her husband. Presumably, what does he have to do? He has to divorce her, obviously. Okay? But at the same time, she's also prohibited from having any further relations with the person with whom she had misconduct. Yeah. Okay? This is a principle that we find in Gemara and several of the Masechtas that deal, you know, with the Kiddushin and particularly, or rather, with Ksubas. And that the woman who has committed adultery, she is asur lebala, she is prohibited to her husband, but she's also asur leboala, she's also prohibited to the man with whom she had relations. So that, for example, let's say he wants to marry her afterwards, from a technical point of view, this would be prohibited because she's not allowed to have any further relations with him. With the him, right? The person with whom you know she had misconduct. Okay.
So she's a defiled woman.
Yeah.
Forever.
Yeah. So, im yomus ba'lo, what would happen if the husband dies? So then she is what? She is asura laboim, right? She's prohibited to him. Oh, Yigarshena, or let's say that the husband divorces her, right? So, in any case, she cannot ever marry the person, you know, who was the boel, not the baal, but the boel, okay? And finally, the yechod, what is the third? Nitma'or, the answer is, Sha'asur l'truma, that she is prohibited from eating truma. So that's why we find it three times in the parsha over there, to show us that she's not only prohibited to her husband once this action has occurred, but also to the paramour, and also that if he is a kohen, the husband is a kohen, then she's not allowed to eat truma anymore. Okay, so those are the three prohibitions. All right, Rashi will conclude this, and then we'll continue with the Gemara text. Okay, the im meis. Now, what would happen if the husband died kodem shehishko, before he caused her to drink the mayim hamorim? The ain loy bonim, and he doesn't have any children from her. The he's a kuko le yavam, and as a result, she is now literally tied into the yavam. In other words, she, has what we call this zika. Zika means like a tie, a bind, a relationship with the husband's brother, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what happens in that case? Then in that particular case, choletzes. Then she has to receive from the brother chalitza so that she could marry anybody else. course, actually, when it says Linosi Lashok, there's one category of person who is not allowed to marry a chalutza. That we learned, of course, when we had Kedusha. Namely, who was that?
A kohen.
A kohen, right. He's not allowed to marry a kohen. Remember, a kohen is not allowed to marry a divorcee. He's not allowed to marry a chalutza, a woman who has received chalitza. And then, of course, he's not allowed to marry a gioris. Okay? And of course, I mean, a woman who has a very bad reputation as having played the field, obviously, then that too would be prohibited to a king.
Kohen
may marry a widow, absolutely. Yes.
Yeah. Only the Kohen Gadol.
The Kohen Gadol was the only one who was prohibited from marrying a widow. Okay? But the Kohen Hedyot, the ordinary Kohen, can certainly marry a widow. Contrary to what Yechezkel says. No, then in that case, that's... Well, if she... Yes, you would be right from this point of view. I mean, technically she would. Whether a kohen would want her, that's already a different story. But but you're right. I mean, because since she does not require chalitza, then in that particular case, she could certainly marry anybody. Okay. So now the Gemara says the following. Okay. I'll tell you what. Yeah, all right. Let's do a little Gemara, and then maybe we'll tackle a Taisvus.
Let me
okay.
see. Yes. Yeah, Bemet. It means that she's not. She cannot go through with the
Yavuma. No. Yeah, Bemet means that in this particular case, that she does not become a Yavuma. She does not marry the Yibum.
Okay.
Remember again that there are two different possibilities. One is Yibum and the other one is Chalitza. Yibum means that the brother-in-law marries her, right? And the Chalitza is, of course, you know, that they go through the ceremony in order that she doesn't marry the brother-in-law and she should be free to marry anybody else, okay?
Okay, no, I thank you.
Right.
That's what I
thought. Pardon me? No, there's no reason for her to do it anymore.
Well, what if she wants to marry the mother?
No, that has nothing to do with it. She wouldn't be allowed to. She's not allowed to. Okay, you raised a very important question, so let me resolve the question right now. Okay?
The question is what?
Okay, Rona, you want to repeat your question?
If the husband died before she had a chance to drink the water,
right.
She had a chance to take the drink the water, then she has to have something that she can't marry the brother.
Yeah.
Okay.
First of all, there is no ceremony of drinking the water if the husband died before, before they went in to the Beis HaMikdash in order to have the ordeal. Okay.
But she's innocent, and she wants to prove that she's innocent.
She doesn't have to. She doesn't have to. Her reputation is still all right, hopefully.
But still, if she wants to marry her brother so that she can have
Okay, but that brings another problem, and that problem is that we have different arroyos. Okay, now the arroyos, you know, besides the ones that are specifically mentioned in the Torah, in Parsha Achrimos, and repeated to a certain extent in Kedosha. Okay, where obviously. You're not allowed to marry your mother, you're not allowed to marry your sister, you can't have any relations with them, okay? And you're not allowed to do it to your aunt, etc., etc., you know. All these are prohibited relations. But this also applies to the fact that you're not allowed to marry the brother of your husband. It's only a special ruling that the Torah gave in the case of Yibum, in order to take care of this woman. But as a normal rule, she's not allowed to do it. Just as, for example, a man is not allowed to marry his wife's sister. Okay? Except if his wife died, then he's allowed to marry her. Mm-hmm. But if the wife did not die, let's say he divorced his wife, then he can never marry her sister. That's a prohibited relationship. So this is also a prohibited relationship, and it's only an exception that the Torah made in this particular case, but not as a normal rule. Okay.
But in this instance, if she would legitimately be a candidate for Yibum. Yeah.
But the only reason that she's not a candidate is because her husband was jealous of her, and he thought that she might have. She was suing the husband.
Uh huh. Right.
He died before.
Okay.
Now
I understand your question a little better.
And
right.
So now she wants to do Yibum because she knows that she did it, and she feels that she should go ahead and do what the Torah wants of her.
Okay. But the answer would be that inasmuch as a cloud of suspicion had already circled about her, even though it hadn't been proved and she hadn't gone through the ordeal, etc., etc. So this is the reason why, you know, the Besdin has to insist that she gets Yibum and not Chalitza. She has to get Chalitza and not Yibum. It's not up to her. It's not up to her. It's the Besdin that makes this decision in this case, okay? Yeah. Because in the final analysis, the Besdin anyway has to affirm whether, you know, then the marriage is a valid marriage or not. And so, and you know, and if whether Yibum or Chalitza takes place, it would still have to be in the presence of a Beis Din in order to confirm. So here the Beis Din is instructed not to, that she should have Chalitza and she should not be permitted to have Yibum. Okay? Yeah. Well, not before the Beis Din. He wanted to bring her to the Kohen for the ordeal of doing the Mayim and Ma'orim, which is it's a little different. It's not the same thing. But if he dies beforehand, then obviously she doesn't have to go through it. But the question is only that if she had no children, so what would be the case? Does she have to have Yibum or Chalitza from the brother?
I think what Mr. Rosen's question is, how does she clear her name?
Yeah.
I understand. We understand. But we have to say that, okay.
You know, if she was,
right.
She was
innocent, how does she clear
her situation? Let's say her husband was just really a jealous person.
Right.
And, you know, he just.
Unfortunately, it could happen that he's a jealous person, yes. Yeah.
Innocent, and she wanted to prove that she was innocent because she really did want to carry on his name and marry his brother so that she could carry on his name.
You know,
would she say, please let me go to the Kohen and let me drink this water and show you that I didn't do anything wrong, and then I could have you.
I would say that the Besdin would say nix.
But you know, there's a certain logic in this position, because once the accusation is made, then the the procedure is, in order to determine guilt or innocence, that you go through the drinking the bitter waters, right? Okay, and at this point, the only thing that stops this is the death of a husband, and the logic that there's no longer a jealous husband, right? But still, there's the logic on the side of the argument that you still haven't made the determination of guilt or innocence,
correct?
Which has an importance.
Okay.
That's actually, has an importance even if she did not want to take the practical step of wanting to.
I would have to say, I mean, at this particular point, that while we could argue logic, but the question is, would it have been done? Obviously, I have to tell you something else. The ordeal is an ordeal, okay? They really want to avoid the ordeal, because one of the actions, as we saw from the Torah, is what's going to happen. You write the words taken from the Torah of the curse, and it has God's name mentioned in it. And then the water has to be used in order to erase God's name. So that, therefore, the feeling is, this is not the right action. I mean, we know that, you know, you have to, you know, you're not allowed under normal circumstances to erase God's name. This is why we write
part
in
GDSD,
etc., etc. You know, we try to avoid in any way possible, you know, to write God's name in a way that we're going to have to erase it or burn it or something like that. Not allowed to do it, okay? So that therefore they don't want the ordeal to take place. So if the husband died, they certainly wouldn't want the ordeal to go. And while we can understand, you know, that she wants to clear her name. But so it won't be the husband's brother. Maybe she could say, you know, I don't like my husband. He was a jealous so-and-so. And I don't like his family either. So she should be happy. In other words, that Tinosei Lashuk, she can marry anybody else that she wants to and find happiness with another man. That's all.
But her yeah, reputation is still as...
Well,
that's the point.
She finds marital happiness with another man, Gesundheit, so forget about reputation, Heidenbrocken, okay?
Could you find a little social attitude here, which I've seen in other parts of the world to this day, and unfairly to the woman, tells her what she cannot do, simply even to the point of talking to a man. We started this beginning that she's seen talking to a man.
Not to a man simply, but to a certain man of whom the husband is suspicious. In other words, it's not that the woman can't talk to anybody in the street.
So you're saying, she could be talking and have no problem.
That's correct.
Because in some society she can't talk to the man.
No, this is not the case.
Right.
The case is obviously, you know, where there's a certain guy who the husband suspects that the things are warming up too much between his wife and the man. Okay?
The rights of the woman.
Right.
I don't see it allowed to this day, but it's okay.
No, I mean, look.
In China, if a girl is a virgin, and under penalty of her life, she is not supposed to talk to a man while she's a virgin.
Well, this is the wedding extreme.
Yes. Well,
but, you know, actually, I don't know about that, but I did see something on the news about Afghanistan where they seem to be almost to the idea. Well, they're according to this, according to this news report, women had to stay in the home, so inferentially, if they went out and spoke to someone in the street, perhaps
they could go veiled or something like that. Now, look, let's not say that what happens among Muslims in Afghanistan automatically is the same thing that happened in Eretz Yisrael. First of all, we don't have the ordeal anymore, so that it doesn't exist, okay? And secondly, I don't think that Jewish life, even when it was enforced, was actually ever as
rigid
as rigid as you're trying to tell me. I mean,
well,
talking
this
about...
This is
it. Right, it didn't happen every day in the week. Okay, you can be sure of that. Unfortunately, there were times when it did happen, that's all.
Well, even until modern times, I think, not to keep this going too long, but in modern times, if a husband went to the Bet Din, the wife was not allowed to come into the picture.
No, that's not true. Not true. It depends on what circumstances you're talking.
Well, if he was going to divorce her, she had no...
No. Sam, please. First of all, since the Chibur Rabbeinu Gershom, a wife is not compelled to accept a divorce from her husband, period. She can say she refuses to accept a divorce, okay?
He's the guy that said you can only marry one wife, right?
Correct. But also the question of divorce. I mean, a woman cannot be compelled to accept a divorce. Has to be an agreement between both husband and wife.
By the way, this
for it to be valid.
A bit of water supply before men had were restricted to one wife. He could have had two or three wives.
Yeah, presumably if it was possible.
Right, and if he suspected one wife of being unfaithful, he would.
He would like to be divorced from her, not have to pay her ksuba.
On that, that's a kind of an economic point. Going back to Rona's point, I think it may depend on the historical period. When you're saying it's not such a bad thing, she can go and marry someone else.
Right.
That kind of presumes a more a different period of time historically, where I guess perhaps the economy was better, or there was more of a settled population, or there was more opportunity.
Yeah.
But in the Chumash, when we were first introduced to this, really get a very clear impression that the right of Yibum for a woman was that of a really tantamount of economic security and social acceptance.
No, but also in order to make sure that there's continuity of the dead person's
Yes,
lives.
I understand that. I understand that. But
that's the basic reason. Because if it weren't for that, the Torah never would have given permission for a man's brother to marry the widow.
I have no argument with that. I just think that I can understand that why it would be very important for the woman to try to clear her name. Why she that right to go through the ceremony would be
But
important.
I cannot imagine that any woman would want to go through this business where she's told by the Kohen that if you have been unfaithful, your belly will swell, your thigh will fall, you'll become a curse among people, and so on and so forth. It's not a pleasant thing.
Even if she were innocent.
Right, even if she were innocent. Absolutely. And, we've only just started this business. We'll see that there are all kinds of hedges involved over here. Hedges on the part of the man, hedges on the part of the woman. We've only gotten through the first Mishnah so far.
That's because you chose well.
Well, I figured, after all, there are things that we can learn from here. Like marital harmony, marital discord, plus there'll be other things too that we'll find very interesting as we continue with the Gemara. Okay. So the Gemara fires once and starts by saying, Nichti. Let's see, it says, Tano Menoza Solik. That our Tana, in other words, the Baal HaMishnah, starts from first Nozir. Take a look. You have only single copies, but if you have the big Gemara, so you see that the way it's arranged over here in the Gemara is that Nozir
precedes
Sota. Okay? So he says, My Tano de Katana Sota. So the question is, why exactly do we have this order that the Baal HaMishnah, learns Sota after Nozir? Okay? We would expect that if it was to go in accordance with the order in which we find it in the Torah. So as we saw at the beginning of the hour, this is for the benefit of the latecomers, we saw that in the Torah first comes the Parshas Sota and then comes Parshas Nozir. This is of course in Parshas Nozir. Okay, so why, when they arranged the Gemara, didn't they go in the order of the Torah, but instead they went in the order that Nozir precedes Sota? So the answer is, there's a good reason. Kidarabi, this is in accordance with Rabbi, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. After all, he was the person who was in charge of the Sanhedrin at the time when they decided to arrange the Mishnayos and things like that, right, to codify it. And so he had a reason for putting Nozir before Sota. The Tanya. So we learned Gemara and Brachas that we had. It says Rabbi Omer. Rabbi says, "Lomo nisbicho pashas nozir pashas soita." Why is it that we find the parsha of the Nazarite juxtaposed? Big word with the parsha of Sota. It says Lomo lecho, to teach you the following: Shekol haroe Sota bikul kula. That whoever sees a sota and sees how disgraced she has become, yazir atzma minayayin, then he should take a vow not to indulge in wine, right? He has to abstain from wine. Because presumably it was the very fact, that they became intoxicated that the monkey business occurred. So that if you don't become intoxicated, you'll be more careful as far as your conduct is concerned.
Not necessarily the witness that testifying against her, but it could be anybody witnessing
anybody
witnessing her disgrace.
Of course, anybody. Exactly. you know, you heard about so and so, terrible story, scandal, you know.
Take a vow immediately.
Makes the National Enquirer, whatever it may be, you know. So therefore you should learn. Stay away from wine, it can lead to all kinds of bad conduct, okay? And so now, next question is, well, listen, and so look. So it says, maybe we should learn Sota of a Hodo Listei Nozir. First we should learn Sota and then learn Nozir. So he says, either the Tonic Suba is the Tona Hamadir, Tona the Dorim. Okay? So this, in order to understand what it says over here, we have to be a little bit familiar with the order in which we find various Gemaras arranged. Okay? So first of all, he says that, okay, we have, first of all, a Gemara, Kesubas. Okay? We've all heard of it. Okay? Mm-hmm. Kesubas, of course, deals, to begin with, you know, with the idea of, you know, the marriage contract and so on, how much it should be, but in general goes into all kinds of inyonim as far as marriage is concerned, right? And there's one of the chapters over there says, V'tona Hamadir. And then one of the chapters deals with a Mishnah which says that if a person, a man, takes a vow that he's going to abstain, not permit his wife to have a certain, let's say, food or something like that, and so on. I mean, the nether could be different things. It all depends what it is. I mean, some things are permitted and others are not permitted as far as
he restricts her in a certain way.
There's a restriction, correct. So, inasmuch as in Kesubas there is such a chapter, so then Tananadorim. So that's why the next Gemara that they have after Kesubas is Nadorim. Okay? Because inasmuch as it's already been mentioned Hamadir, in other words, he makes a nether against, you know, that she shouldn't do this or that, or he wouldn't do this or that in relation to her, whatever it may be, okay? So that's why, in general, they go in then into the next Gemara, into the general vow, the idea of vows, the dorm.
It
okay?
could be another reason for it.
Yes.
It could be, I mean, a marriage vow. The marriage contract,
well,
and a marriage vow.
Yeah, of course, I am being, you know, I can't give you the Torah of Regalachas, okay? But let me say it, I mean, I said just a few moments ago that a person could make a vow which would be valid, but in other respects, a person cannot make a vow. It has no validity whatever. You cannot, the general principle is that you cannot make a vow against anything that the Torah itself has already specifically stated. You can only take a vow in reference to something that the Torah is silent about. If I, for example, would say that I hereby take upon myself a vow that I'm going to give up smoking, I'm not going to smoke anymore. Okay? Person can do that. Why? Because in the final analysis, the Torah has nothing to say about smoking. Although, according to a later opinion, a very late opinion of Rav Moshe Feinstein prior to his Patira, he felt that maybe smoking should come under the category of a general prohibition that we have in the Torah, which says, "V'nishmartem miyodah nafshecheichem," that you have to watch, literally, your souls. It means you have to do those things that are going to keep you
alive,
healthy, and not endanger your life. And so that smoking maybe comes into that category too. But this was reached at a later opinion in his life, because prior to that he felt that it was permissible, since so many yeshiva bochrim and rebbeim and so on, that they were smoking anyway. Okay? So, to get back, I can make a vow that, you know, I take upon myself not to smoke. I could also take a vow that I prohibit my wife from smoking. Because after all, she's living with me, and I don't want to have the house contaminated with smoke and so on. So I can take a vow and say that I hereby take a vow that you're not allowed to smoke. Okay. But he cannot take a vow, for example, saying that from this point on, I take a vow never to have any marital relations with you. That's a violation of the Torah. The Torah says that a husband has certain obligations to his wife, right? She'ira kasusu v'yenosa. In other words, he has to provide for her food, he has to provide for her clothing, he has to provide for her sexual needs and so on, right? He's not allowed to do that. So, this he cannot do because he is in violation of something that the Torah specifically said, that this is a mitzvah and you're not allowed to take a, you know, a neder against what is a mitzvah.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I say, you know, I'm not going into the whole discussion over here, but I just want to indicate, you know, what are some of the problems. However, what he's interested over here in this question right now is there a reason for a certain order in which the Masechtas come in the Talmud? So we gave Rabbi's opinion already, what? That the reason why Sota follows Nazir is to tell us, you know, that if you see the Sota Bilkukula, so in that particular case, you should know that you should take a vow not to drink wine, okay? Because intoxication leads to bad conduct, okay? To misconduct. All right. So now the question is, all right, good. How about some of the other Gemaras? So why, for example, those Kesubas, why is it followed by Nidorim? Maybe it should be followed by something else, like Kedushin. You understand?
Mm-hmm.
Because there's an intimate relationship between Kesubas and Kedushin. They're both dealing with laws of marriage, right? But the answer, so why does Nidorim come in over here? So he says, well, inasmuch as there was already a Mishnah in Kesubas which mentions a Neder, right? So Tana Nidorim, that's the reason why the Gemara at this particular point then introduced the Seches Nidorim after Kesubas. Now, the Ida, the Tana Nidorim, and inasmuch as the now, you know, Rabbi and his Bezdin, you know, they decided, you know, to learn Nidorim, the laws pertaining to vows of this type. So Tana Nazir. So therefore it is followed by what? It's followed by Maseches Nazir. Why? Because the Domi Nidorim. When a person is a Nazirite, it's as though he's taken upon himself a vow. Because the Torah says it's Kiyafli Neder Lahazir. Okay? So it's a form of a vow. So in as much as we dealt with vows in general, so now we come to this specific type of a vow. And finally, the Kotoni Soto. And why then is it followed by Soto? It says, could the Rebbe, even this Rebbe already said, because of what we said, Soto Bikukula, right, Yazar Atzmo Minayayin. Okay, we'll just take a look at the Rashi, and we'll call it a night tonight, okay? It says, Nichte Tana Menozir Kosolik, inasmuch, right, that, you know, following Nozir comes Sota, it says, Kain Seder HaMishnah, this is the order of the Mishnah, Sota Achar Nozir, right? So, and then he says, My Tana, the Tana Sota, so why particularly? So he says, My Tana Benazirus, what? In other words, do we find in Nazir that is the Domi L'Soita, which has, it's literally similar to Soita, in other words, it's a connection. The Tana Soita Basra that we learned said afterwards, so the answer that Rabbi gave is that if you see a Soita the Kilkula, which means Benivula Uvivashta, in other words, the way she has been shamed and disgraced, right? Sheminavlin Osa, because they shame her. What do? As we said before, the Katani Bimasnisan, as we're going to learn afterwards in the Mishnah, what is the procedure? So the Torah, if you recall, mentions the fact, you know, that the Kohen has to remove her head covering and, you know, loosen her hair, undo her hair, which was considered already a disgrace for a woman who, if she's a tzinuah, she should keep her head covered, right? But there's another thing. It says, kosher chevel amalom in dadeha, that part of the procedure in order to make her feel disgraced for what she has done, so he has to tie a rope above her breasts. And so that in itself also is already, it's a sign, you know, like, for example, the Hawthorne story about putting a scarlet A, so this is also, it's a sort of like a scarlet A for the, a scarlet letter A for the woman. Okay. All right. So, Yazir Atzmai Minayayin, Shehayayin, maybe the day kalas roish, because wine brings about intoxication and lightheadedness. In other words, you do things that you shouldn't be doing. Hu gam lo, and obviously this is what happened. Okay, then it says, well, this neisoit v'hoda nozer. So, all right, so let's learn sota, and then maybe we should learn nozer afterwards. Shekachi smichas parshasayu, because this is the way in the Torah the arrangement goes, right?
Only works at Oxley.
We had ksubis, then the Tana Hamadir, Perikub Ksubis, it says, Hamadir is Ishtay, right? There is a chapter in Ksubis which begins with the words that he takes a vow concerning his wife. The Ida, the Ira, the Nedarim, and inasmuch as he's already talking about, you know, making a Neder, so Tana Nedarim, Acha Ksubis, right? So therefore you have Maseches Nedarim following Ksubis. The Ida, the Tana Nedarim, and inasmuch as he's already taught Nedarim, so in that case, Tana Nozer, Basra. So then he teaches Nozer. Why? Sha'af ha-Niziris bo'al yidei neder. Because Niziris too has to result from a vow. He cannot be a Nozer without taking a vow of being a Nozer. The Hoda Tana is Sota Basra. All right. And afterwards he learned Sota following it. And as we say, in order to reinforce what Rabbi said concerning Karoa, Sota Bikul Kula, then you know, Yasser has been Yayin. So we will stop at this particular point. Just want to mention again.
Alright. They're on.
Good. Alright. To summarize what we learned in the Mishnah, because then we saw that the Gemara began by discussing what is the order of the Gemara. Why does it have first Ksubas? Then after Ksubas, why does it go into Nedarim? Why then after that do we have Nozer? And why do we have Saita? So this we discussed, that the reason is because in Kesubis there was something that had to deal with the Neder, namely Perek HaMadir, and in Nedarim logically would follow then Kesubis. And how about Nozer? Well, obviously, because as we said before, in order to be a Nozer you have to vow that you're going to be a Nozer. And then finally, Sota, because of the fact, as we said, why are the two of them placed next to each other? Because if you see the result of intoxication, then, you know, Yazar Asim Ben Yayin, and then you won't fall into an illicit marital relationship or whatever it may be. But the Mishnah, if you remember, began with the Machlokes, it began with a difference of opinion between Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yehoshua. Let's take a look at the first lines of the Mishnah again at the top of the page, where we see that Hamakani Liishtoi, if a person literally is jealous of his wife, but as we learned afterwards, what it means is that he gives a formal notice that she's not, you know, to be seen with a certain, you know, to be in seclusion with somebody else, because just to be seen in a public place, that wouldn't affect it anything. Okay, so Rabbi Eliezer, he says that Mekadilal Pishnayim, that in other words, he has to make this declaration in the presence of two witnesses. Don't altisosri, right? Don't go into seclusion with Ishplaini, with this and this particular man. Okay. And then he says a mashkal pi edechod, but he can cause her, you know, to drink the mayim ha'ma'orim only on the, if there's the testimony of even only one witness. I mean that she then went into seclusion, and of course, as we said afterwards, and she had to stay a certain minimum amount of time, which would indicate the fact that she was up to monkey business with this man, because otherwise, you know, if she only stepped in and stepped out again, then obviously there were no charges to bring against her. Okay. And also he says, O al pi atzmo. In other words, he may not require one witness, that the man himself can decide, you know, that he wants to bring charges against his wife, that he saw her in seclusion after he had already warned her in the presence of the two witnesses not to, and so therefore this is why he wants to bring her to the kohen and you know, have it tested with the mayim ha'ma'orim. But Rabbi Yehoshua says mekani lo al pishnayim and mashke al pishnayim, right? He says that he has to give her this warning in the presence of two witnesses, and if he wants her to drink the Mayim Ma'orim, then he requires two witnesses to state the fact, you know, that they saw it specifically that the woman had secluded herself for at least the amount of time that would be necessary to assume that something bad had taken place over there. And if not, then in that particular case, there's no case. He cannot bring it to, you know, to the Beis Hamikdash, right? It's not a Beis Din, actually, it's to the Beis Hamikdash that he brings it to. He brings it to the Kohen because it says in the Torah exactly. Specifically that it's the Kohen who has to pass judgment on it. So this is what we learned last week. So coming back now to the Mishnah, we see that the Gemara now continues, and it says, Hamakane, now they are specifically looking at the language Hamakane, because it means the one who suspects, all right, and then after that we have the Machlekes, okay. So they say Hamakane means the Eved, in. In other words, if it has already happened that he gave a warning and so on and so forth, right, then in that particular case he, you know, he can then proceed with the rest of it. But l'chatchila lo. But to begin with, he shouldn't even give his wife that warning, he shouldn't be jealous of her, etc., etc. So, why? So they say, kosovar tana didon osir lekanas. Says, because our tana is of the opinion that it is prohibited for a man to act in this way that he is suspicious of his wife. Understand?
Mm-hmm.
In other words, that the marital life should be based on harmony and not upon suspicion and hatred and so on and so forth. So, Omer Rav Shmuel bar Rav Yitzchak, Rav Shmuel, the son of Rav Yitzchak, said, Ki hava posach Reish Lakish b'seita. He says, when Reish Lakish began giving drushes about Sota, you see, posach is a technical term over here. We find it used very often, particularly in the midrash. Okay, that posach rab so and so, posach rabbi so and so. That means that he began explaining or talking about this particular topic. Okay, so in this case, Reish Lakish was delivering a drasha about sota. So Omar. So he said at this particular point, he says that, as a matter of fact, the, so to speak, I guess, the heavenly arrangement would be that they do not make a zivik for a person except in accordance with his own deeds. Shenemar, as the pasuk says, in Tehillim it says, Ki lo yanuach shevet horesha al goral hatzadikim. Which means literally the rod or the staff of the wickedness will not affect, literally will not be over the fate of the tzaddikim. So, what does that mean? What it means is, very simply, that if a guy is a Rasha, then he deserves a wife who will be a Rishoa. If the guy is a tzaddik, then he should marry a tzaddikus. Okay? That's what the zivik should be.
Zivik meaning match.
The match, right. The match between husband and wife. This is what he says, okay? So, Omer Rabbi Bar Chonah, so Rabbi Bar Chonah said, Omer Rabbi Yochanan, name of Rabbi Yochanan, he said, the caution is Zabkan Kukriyas Yamsun. He says that it is as difficult to make matches for the Rebbeinu Shalalam as it was also to. Part the Red Sea. That's how difficult it is. Yes. One is a tremendous miracle, and the other one is also a tremendous miracle. It's a tremendous miracle if the Rebbeinu Shalom can get a man and a woman to live together in harmony and be suitable to each other. This is a boy. Okay. And he has a posuk for that. What is the posuk? That's Shenema. There's a posuk in Tehillim which says, Elohim Moshev Yechidim Baiso. Which means that God causes the individuals to dwell in the home, and Motzi Asir Mekosharos, and he takes out the prisoners, or he releases the prisoners, he frees the prisoners, would be a better translation, Mekosharos. Now, what is Mekosharos? One translation is so that they could live in harmony and amenity and so on. As we'll see, however, in a moment, we're going to take a look at the Rashi, and then we'll see how he interprets it, which is the more traditional interpretation of this particular pasuk. Okay? All right, why don't we stop and take a look at the Rashi up to this particular point, and then we'll continue. All right? All right, we already did the first part over there. Right, the other was another. So, So now. Okay, I'll tell you what. We didn't really get to this new point yet. Yeah, okay. It says, all right. This is where we started, where it says, L'chatchila lo. In other words, remember, he says that Hamekane, why does it have a hey at the beginning? So he says that indicates b'diyamin. He was already jealous, and so therefore this is sets into motion, you know, the whole process of the kinui, stira, etc., etc., and the hashpa, mashka, okay? So, but l'chatchila to begin with, lo, you should not do it. It says, midelo tani Rabbi Eliezer omer, mekane yodem li yishto al pishnaim, inasmuch as Rabbi Eliezer does not say that mekane, right, al pishnaim, which would mean that a person does so, which would mean, in other words, that it's almost like tantamount to saying what? That it's almost a tantamount to saying it's a mitzvah for a man to do this thing. This is what a man has to do. He has to be mekane. But that's not the meaning of it, right? Because, as we said, our Tana says it's osur lekanos, right? It's prohibited for a man to be suspicious of his wife. Shemevi atzmal edei tagar. Why? Because as a result of his suspicions, he brings himself into a state of quarreling, okay? Yes, ishto ledei nivul, and not only that, but it's going to result in disgrace for his wife. Needless to say, not only will people be talking about her, but as we also had before last week in the Rashi, we see that at the time of this ceremony where he brings it to the Beis HaMikdash, to the Kohen over there, and they go through the whole process. So part of it consists actually of making her feel disgraced. Menuvel, okay? You heard the expression, menuvel, right? Nivel, okay? Part of it remembers the fact that, for example, her hair has to be loosened, which was a disgrace for its knees to kefor, you know, who was supposed to keep her head covered. And then also, we learn from Rashi, I mean, that they tie a rope around her breasts over there, which obviously is not meant as a bra, but it's meant, you know, again, as a sign of the fact, you know, that she deserves to be disgraced or something like that, you see. So, if he's going to be jealous of her, not only is he going to bring in quarrel into his own life, with his wife, but also it will also result in that his wife also will be disgraced. V'afilu hi tahora, says Rashi, even if she's completely innocent. But the very fact that he brings her, you know, he causes suspicion to fall upon her, this already is a terrible disgrace for her. Ki posach, says Kishahoya bo lidroish v'parsha sotna, when he began to give drushes, you know, to interpret Parsha Sot and so on. So then he said, Mizavgin isha lefi ma'asav. In other words, they make shidduchim between a man and a woman according to their deeds. Sinua, a woman who is modest, latzadik. She is, right, she is destined, you know, to marry a man who is righteous. Ufrutza, but on the other hand, a woman who is a loose woman,
the
Russia,
the Russia,
right? And then the pasuk lo yanu ashevat harish al gol atzadikim. So he says it means lo yizdaveg b'mshelis Russia. In other words, the ruling of the Russia will not be mated to the girl tzadik, to the fate of the righteous. So in other words, rishoyim are mated with each other, and tzaddikim are mated with each other. That's how he interprets the pasuk, okay? And then he said, if you remember, the kashin, they are difficult, lizavkam, so he says, to whom is it difficult? it's not just the question that the male and the female find difficulty in matching each other, but it's l'pnei amokim. In other words, Rabbeinu Shalom too has his difficulty in trying to make the right shidduch between the man and the woman. Okay, it's difficult. He says, "Lizavkam hanech d'lepi ma'asov," you know, to try to match up according to their own deeds and character. It's as difficult as Kriyas Yamsuf. What was the great problem with Kriyas Yamsuf? He says, "Shenishtanu sidrei bereishis." The Rebbeinu Shalom, when he created the world, he created the world that should be orderly, run in accordance with the, you know, the laws that govern the, how nature should function, right? And here, at Yamsuf, what happened? He had to create a miracle which completely was contrary to the normal course of events. So he was as though he was destroying the sidra, you know, the sidra operations. Yes.
So why does he mention Kriyas Yamsuf? Why doesn't he mention the Mabul, which came long before? It was much worse.
Well, granted, but the Mabul was complete destruction.
Yeah.
Right. Whereas Kriyas Yamsuf eventually resulted in the Geula for the people of Israel from Egypt.
That,
so
the
we're looking
of
for
Israel
right.
Witnessed it.
Yes. Yeah. But essentially, it's the idea of the Geula. After all, what do we say? And then go all Yisrael. We praise God. You know who redeemed Israel. So this was the act of redemption from the slavery of Egypt. Yes.
Do we also say that Kriyat Yom Suf followed, in a sense, the laws of nature that Hashem put down?
Yes.
As it followed the tides and
yes. Yeah. Right. I mean, actually,
it wasn't. According to this line of thinking, it wasn't upsetting the laws of nature that Hashem had put into place.
No, I understand. I mean, what you're saying is a very valid interpretation. I mean, if you read the text in the Torah, so it says, you know, that the Lord caused a ruach kodim azor kol alayla. He caused a very strong east wind to blow all night long. So vayosem es hayom lecharavo. And as a result, it made the sea into dry land, right? By Yabokla Maiman, the waters became split. This is correct. But still, even that, the Rebbeinu Shalom had to work hard in order to produce, okay? And so, as difficult as it is for the Rebbeinu Shalom to create the Kriyas Yamsuf and to free the people of Israel from Egypt, so it's just as difficult in order to find the proper matches for a Tzaddik and for a Rasha. Okay. There's a very famous Medrash also upon this theme. Chazal tell us that you know, Rabbi Yehoshua always had to deal with the Romans. And, he was really like one of the finest envoys that the Jewish people had to Rome and the emperor and so on and so forth. So he made the acquaintance of a very important woman, the matronesa, as we would say, you know, it's from the Latin word matrona, which means a matron, in other words, a woman of high stature, I would say. So she asked him one time, I mean, what is the difficult? So he said, you know, Kriyas Yamsuf. He answered her that, you know, for the Rebbeinu Shalom to match up the right people in marriage is a very difficult thing. So she says, why? He says it's as difficult as Kriyas Yamsuf. Yeah. So she said, I can do the same thing. I can make all kinds of matches. So she had hundreds of slaves, thousands of slaves. So she had, let's say, hundreds of slaves. Okay. So she had 100 men slaves and 100 women slaves, and she lined them all up, and she said, you get married to this one, you marry this one, you get married to this one, you marry this one, et cetera, et cetera. She had mass marriage, okay? The following morning, they came into her, and this one his nose was broken, and this one had his arm broken, and this one, and so on and so forth. And they all yelled to her, I don't want him. She says, I don't want him. She says, right. I don't want him. He says, I don't want her, and so on and so forth. They're all bruised, and so on and so forth. And they all want out of the marriage, okay? So then she said to Rabbi Yehoshua, I see that you're really true. It's really true what you said, you know, that it is difficult to make matches between men and women as the Kriyas Yamsuf. Yeah. So it's a famous midrash based upon the same theme that we have over here. Okay. So, Moshe Yechidim Bayis, so now the question is, how did they derive this idea of the difficulty of marriage and the difficulty of Kriyas Yamsuf out of a pasuk in Tehillim, which says that Elokim Moshe Yechidim Bayis, right? That God causes the individuals to dwell alone at home, right? And then Motzi Asirim B'Koshavos, that he frees the prisoners, where he takes them out of their bondage, you know, B'Koshavos. So he says, Adam Yochid, the Isha Yechidim. In other words, who is the Yechidim that we're referring to? A man who is alone, in other words, he's not married, right? The Yeshua Yechid, the woman who is unmarried. The whom is Avgum Yachat, right? And he matches them together. Umiyashiv Mehem Bias. And he establishes from the man and the woman a new home, a household, okay? Motzi Astir Mikosha Rose. So he says, this is a reference, as we'll see now, to Yetzias Mitzrayim. He says, Hotzi Es Yisrael Mi Mitzrayim. Right? The Chodesh Kosher. He took them out of Egypt in a month which is kosher. Naturally, what month is it? The month of Nisan, right? So, how is it a kosher month? So, he says it's Lo Chamo, Velo Tzino. It's not a month where it's too hot, and it's not a month where it's too cold. So, that this is a very nice, pleasant month, right? Yeah. So he says, Makish, as a result, inasmuch the Pasuk speaks about first men and women, right? The Yechidim Baisos, so Zivuk Yechidim, in other words, Hadol Beinu Shalelam lines up those who are single and makes them into a married pair. Litzias Mitzrayim, and he compares one to the other, so in the same Pasuk. Okay. So far we see that it's a wonderful miracle that the Bnei Shalom performs, right? And what is it? In order to match the tzaddikim with tzidkoniyos, right? And the prutza with the Russia and so on, okay? But, needless to say, we have other traditions which are not exactly in consonance with this. So this is what he says now. The whore, hey, wait a moment, he says. How about this? We have a tradition that says Amarav Yehuda, Amarav, that Rav Yehuda said in the name of Rav, that our boy Yim Yom called them Yitzchak of Lot, 40 days prior to the forming of the child, because we're talking about the embryo, right? Before the child is actually born, so 40 days prior to the fact that the child is born, Bas Kol Yotzeis, right? And a Bas Kol goes. A heavenly voice goes, we omeris, and it says, Bas Ploni Lefloni, the daughter of so and so is destined to be married to Ploni. Bas Ploni, the house of Ploni, is destined to belong to Ploni. Sede Ploni, the field of Ploni, is destined, right, Lefloni. So, in that particular case, this would seem to contradict what we read before. Right? If, in other words, it's already ordained, right? So why does the Rebbeinu Shalom have to sweat so hard in order to find the right zivugim, to find, you know, a tzaddik for a tzaddikus, and vice versa, and a rasha for a prutza, and vice versa, right? So he says, like kasha. He says, it's not a kasha. Why? He says, ho b'zug rishayin, ho b'zug sheni. He says, if it is a first marriage, then in that case, what we learned about the Yarboyim Yom Kodim Yitzchus Havlad, that, you know, 40 days prior to the formation of the child, the Basco says, you know, Bas Ploni Leploni, right? So that applies only to the first marriage. But what happens if chas v'sholem things go wrong in the marriage between them? Then in that case, it'll be a zug sheni. If you have a second marriage, there the Rebbeinu Shalom has to sweat in order to be able to find the right mate, you know, for each other. Okay. The right woman for the right man, and and the wrong woman for the wrong man, so to speak. Okay, so we'll finish up the Rashi for this little section over here.
Okay.
Yeah. Pardon me? We're up to Eini, isn't it so, right? So he says, Mi havizivig lefi Rashi v'zechus. He says, is the zivik really based upon wickedness or being, you know, a tzaddik, you know, tzchus? So it's v'hoa mekaydem yitzirasam. Why? Even before they were born, right? She'ein noda risho tzchuso, where we don't know whether they're going to be a rasha or a tzaddik, right? Machrizen Zugo, they already announced that this one is destined to marry this one, right? The Yim Tomar, and if you argue as follows, very interesting what Rashi says now. Says, if you want a Hakol Galui Lefonov, right? That everything is revealed to the Rebbeinu Shalom, right? So he shouldn't have any difficulties. So he says, no, not so easy. Why? Because we learned. This we find in the Gemara in Brachas. I mean, this idea that Hakol Bidei Shemayim, Kutz Biyira Shemayim, that everything is in the hands of heaven except for Yira Shemayim. In other words, the Rebbeinu Shalom will foresee, you know, what's going to happen in general. But there is one area which he leaves completely to the individual, where he does not have predestination, so to speak, namely a person's Yirah Shemayim, a person's piety. Is he going to do what's right, or is he going to do what's wrong with his life? Kedomah b'Maseches Nida, as we say in Maseches Nida, it says over there, Malach HaMemune Al HaEroyot, the angel who is appointed to be in charge of conception, Notel Tipo, he takes a drop, and he brings it to the Rebbeinu Shalom. The Yom Elefonov, and he says to him, Tipozu Matahei Oleha, what's going to happen with this little drop? In other words, when this drop becomes a human being, right? Gibor, will it be strong, right? Or Chalash, or will it be weak? Chacham, will he be wise? Or tipesh? Or foolish? Nar, right? Or shir, rich? Or ani, or poor? Avol tzadik v'rasha lo ka'amale. But he does not mention the word, will he be a tzadik or will he be a rasha? This he doesn't say. Why? De'ein zeh bidei shamayim. Because this is not in the hands of heaven.
You know, I have a problem with this, difficulty with this. Let me see if I understand this correctly. What all this comes down to say is that regarding the first marriage,
right?
In other words, the matching up that takes place before birth.
Yes.
That Hashem has no way, therefore, of matching a tzaddik with a woman that's a tzaddik, right? And correct. So
no, that's not the question, right?
Okay. What we read, which was in the Gemara, supposedly only applies to a second marriage, where it's at some.
This
point
is how they try
lives,
to.
It's known
to resolve the kasha, obviously.
Because the character
right.
of these people is known.
Right. Right. Once the character is known, then it's an even harder job, you see, to for the Rebbeinu Shalom to make a good shidduch, you see.
How then is the match made correctly? I mean,
before birth.
In the original one, the Rabbeinu Shel Olam says, okay, David Hirshhorn is going to marry Beverly. Okay. Okay, Greenberg. Okay. That's the way it is. Okay.
All right. No one knew.
And the Rabbeinu Shel Olam hopes that this is going to be a wonderful tzivik. Okay.
He has no control over whether he's going to be a tzaddik or a rasha.
No, not over tzaddik or rasha. That's the one area in which Rabbeinu Shel Olam doesn't have a control.
Okay. There's no knowledge.
Yeah.
The thing is, not having control does not necessarily mean that you don't know what the outcome is.
Well, from that point of view, right.
The person to be a tzaddik or a rasha.
This is correct.
Does not mean that you cannot know what's going to happen in the end, what decision they're going to make and what path they're going to take.
Right, right.
So that I don't understand Rashi's objection. God has the ability to know what will happen in the end.
Yeah.
But how can you say that and then say it's but law be a day
shemayim?
I mean, I don't follow that.
No. Okay. Obviously.
Right.
Yeah. Correct.
No, I've heard it before. It troubled me before when I heard it before. Seriously, I mean, it troubled me when I heard it before. How can he, on one hand, say, "All right, Hashem is omniscient. He knows. All right, he knows. Even though he cannot control the outcome, he knows." But on the other hand, to say he really cannot control it, if he cannot control it, then he really doesn't.
Let's put it this way: he wants to give human beings the choice.
Yeah.
Okay.
He purposely lived each one make his own decision whether to be good or bad.
Right, right.
Just because God knows what you're going to do doesn't mean you don't have freedom of will.
That's a fact. What you do today, which may be bad, may turn out to be good for the better. You never know. You don't know.
But he does.
For the Rebbeinu Shel Olam.
Therefore,
the match that he made.
But the Rebbeinu Shel Olam is not forcing a person to be either a tzaddik or a rasha. That choice he gives to a human being. I mean, this is why we believe.
He knows who he's matching him up with.
The mother may have different ideas.
You can apply this to other subjects.
That's not what's written here, though.
Well,
that's what
I'm saying. I don't understand
Rashi's
objection, because it doesn't really follow. One thing doesn't follow from the other. Just because God doesn't force you to do something for Russia doesn't mean that he doesn't have the knowledge of which decision you should have going forward.
Let's put it this way. The Rebbeinu Shel Olam knows, but he doesn't force man to go in accordance with him. Because we have to believe that we do have free will.
Correct.
And of course, if we have free will, we also have the responsibility for what we make of our lives, our decisions, and so on and so forth. Through all, it's with, you know.
If he didn't have knowledge of what path we would take, there's no way he could possibly know anything.
Yeah.
Because everything that we do changes along the way.
If he handed us a world that was preordained for the human being, then there would be no progress out of human nature.
Well,
because you can apply this to every situation. God knows. He knows ahead.
Right.
But now he gives the individual free will to judge. But if you had a person who can now quickly, let's say, recognize that everything is set by God, then what kind of a human being would you have?
What you're saying is that even though you have free, I mean, everybody's gone over this before, but I guess it's just troubling. If you know that you have free will, but you also, that Hashem knows what your choice will be with that free will, then in a sense, you do have predestination. There is no situation where there is no predestination.
You know, it's a very difficult philosophical concept. I agree with you 100%. I mean, the way they phrased it in the Pirkei Avos, if you remember, this was Rabbi Akiva.